You're listening to the Book Riot Podcast. It's a weekly news and talk show about what's new, cool, and worth talking about in the world of books and reading. This episode, 373, recording on Thursday, April 30th. Rebecca Shinsky here joining me as always. The last day of April, looking at May, looking at June, looking in July. Looking at a big roadmap of haze, it feels like a little bit, you know?
Yeah, it does. I think it was our coworker Clint sent me a link to like a t-shirt or something that was like 2020 is a leap year. Mm-hmm. Like February has 29 days, March has 30, April has 5 years. And I was like, but what is May going
to
be?
I don't know. It's tough to say. You know, like I usually feel like May 1st. You know, every month changes, just in case anyone was wondering about themselves. But, you know, not every month is the same of a turn. Like, I feel like August to September is an out-of-scale meaningful turn. Mm-hmm. Of course, December to January. But sneakily, I think April to May. February to March, like, you can pretend you're not in winter. But sneakily, April to May feels like, you know, maybe it's fourth out of 12 on the meaningful changes. Because it's like, well, May is summer. Part of May is summer, right? So maybe I'm in summer now. Weather's getting nice. May and October, my two favorite months, I would say. And so of my many resentments, and it's way down the list about what's going on in the world, that this has taken the feeling of May away. Because we only get so many Mays, Rebecca. I don't have infinity Mays laying around.
Yes, I'm having a similar, you know, we can play our tiny violins for these moments, sure. But they're still real violins. Mm-hmm. This is one of the best times of year to be outside. And normally going outside, or like I took the day off earlier this week to go hiking at a state park that was blessedly like completely empty. Mm. That's usually like kind of a sacred and really enjoyable thing for me. And now it's just a survival thing of like, well, I need to move my body and I like going outside and breathing fresh air, whatever. But that place of like nature, joy and deep relaxation is just not accessible at the moment. I don't know anybody who has been able to access that in whatever their usual mode of doing it is. And it's not fair. Part of me just wants to like stomp my feet and be like, but this is not fair. Come on, give me my May back.
Right. Yeah. And the kids and I will go out for a walk or Michelle and I, one of us or all four of us will go out for a walk every day at about 3:30. Mm-hmm. Kind of when their normal school day would end, and we kind of use it as a psychic break to break up the rest of the day.
Yeah.
And I'm moving back and forth between, aren't we lucky that it's so nice out? And dang it, it's so nice out, right? Because if it was February, at least we would be burning May, but then it'd be February, and here we are. So I don't know. Maybe it's hit me today because it's 68 degrees and sunny outside, and we will go for a walk. But we're not going to the coast for 4 days, and we're not going to the zoo, and we're not doing some of the other stuff. And there's not much interesting news really this week either. I mean, we have a few things, like, as we say, we're in this hibernation period in which some things are still happening. Let's do a sponsor break and we'll get into what we do have.
Today's episode is brought to you by Harper Muse, publisher of Troubled Waters. Troubled Waters is an intimate portrait of two generations, a granddaughter and a grandmother, coming to terms with what it means to be family, Black women, and alive in a world on fire. In heartfelt lyrical prose, Mary Inez Hegler weaves an unforgettable story of the climate crisis, Black resistance, and the enduring power of family. Narrated by Janice Abbott Pratt and written by climate justice writer Mary Inez Hegler, the Troubled Waters audiobook is available everywhere May 7th. It follows Corinne as she plans to stage a dramatic act of resistance and peels back the scabs of her family wounds and puts her safety in jeopardy. Both grandmother and granddaughter must bring their unspoken secrets into light to find a path to healing. Known for her essays that dissect and interrogate the climate crisis, drawing heavily on her personal experience as a Black woman with deep roots in the South, Mary Inez Hegler brings us her first work of fiction titled Troubled Waters. Make sure to pick it up. Thanks again to Harper Muse, publisher of Troubled Waters, for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Flatiron Books, publisher of 888 Love and the Divine Burden of Numbers by Abraham Chang. So this is an interesting love story. It's great for fans of Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow and High Fidelity. It's set in the mid-90s at NYU. And it follows young Wang, who has gotten the advice of love through Chinese numerology from his uncle. So he believes that he will have seven great loves in his life. And then he meets Irena in 95. And she's like the best. She's brilliant, charismatic, quick-witted, funny. They fall in love. But the thing is, she's number six. So if he is to have seven great loves, does that mean his time with Irena is going to come to an end? So this is a love letter to Western pop culture, Eastern traditions, and being a first-generation New Yorker. Make sure to check it out. And thanks again to Flatiron Books, publisher of 888 Love and the Divine Burden of Numbers by Abraham Chang, for sponsoring this episode.
I guess before we do that, though, the Pulitzer is coming out next, is supposed to be announced on Monday. We're going to record, do a quick turnaround show for Wednesday next week that'll be discussing whatever happens with the Pulitzer. Wouldn't it be great if they just pulled one of their no word years? Not because of the COVID, just because of like nothing's good enough. So we're not even going to do it this year, but we're going to be talking about whatever happens with Pulitzer next week. Then the next Wednesday, that's the Fried Green Tomatoes. Read the book. I've got my nice mass market paperback. It's ready. Lovely. I've got my pen ready. I think I'm going to dive in this weekend. Did you notice? What format are you reading it in?
I got a trade paperback. Oh.
It has recipes from the Whistle Stop in the back. Did you look at that already?
I didn't. I haven't started reading yet. I'm going to, this will be my first foray into fiction since the pandemic started. And I'm having to like hype myself up for, you can read a story. Right. It'll be fine. But it was sitting next to my desk. So now I'm holding it and I'm looking at candied yams, fried okra, and turnip and collard greens all on the same page. And that, my friends, is living.
I don't want to, I mean, I'm not sure if this is going to step on the show because I haven't read the book ever. And I've seen the movie and it hasn't been in a while, but I haven't watched the movie of late. Though Michelle and I watched the first hour of Steel Magnolias the other night, which is sort of also me feeling like I'm watching Fried Green Tomatoes. until it gets sad. You know, you watch the first hour of Star is Born. I'd put the first hour of Steel Magnolias in the just watch the first hour movie canon of all time. But anyway, I was thumbing through the recipes. And I realized this book was written before the Great American Food Revolution as we know it. Because I'm sure they're all fine, but it's extremely basic for Southern. I was like, oh, these are all, there's no drizzle of the thing on the top of the thing with this. It's just biscuits. You know? It's like, it's just fried green tomatoes. Like, fried green tomatoes was the fancy thing.
It's like this is before like New York chefs discovered Southern cooking and did a bunch of stuff to it. But like Southern food is still like in people's homes, at least, is still like relatively simple, like these things.
But to give this recipe book now, it's like saying, have you heard of vanilla ice cream? It's like, yeah, I'm good. I, you know, it's great, but, you know, I'm good.
Yeah, this is the kind of stuff that, who wrote The Best Cook in the World that we, Rick Bragg. This is the kind of stuff his mom would have cooked.
Yes, his mom would have done it exceptionally well. And look, it's fried green tomatoes in cornmeal and fried in bacon and pork fat. So it's not like, you know, you're still, that you're coming up from the bottom there of the pig and you're making everything out of that. So anyway, I just thought it was interesting to see. It's like, oh, this isn't buttermilk graffiti version of fried green tomatoes, right? It's not something like that, which is more typical what you'd be reading a recipe for.
Yeah, I should look and see if there's a fried green tomatoes recipe in Smoke and Pickles, which is Edward Lee's great Southern fusion cookbook. But yeah, those are fancy recipes that like just have a flair of Southern to them.
So there's that. Welcome to Cookbook Corner. And I guess my critique of the recipes in a 30-year-old novel is what just happened. I'm sorry for that. Not really a critique, an observation. That's fine.
Maybe we should like cook some of the fried green tomatoes recipes.
Well, that's what I was thinking. I was like, oh, make some. He's like, oh, but none of them. I mean, sure, but I'm not like, oh, look at this weird recipe. They're within the realm of normal, and I've made stuff and have made for me, you know, by people who are Southern cooks as well. Like, this is stuff that, like, I would have had at Michelle's grandparents' house, like, 10 years ago. which is fine. It's good to have that recipe, but it's not like, look at this weird, interesting, you know, edgy, even though her name is Iggy, recipe from from Fried Green Tomatoes. Also, I have this in my notes already for the show, and I'll just spoil it already here. But the epigraph is a quote from one of her own characters from Fanny Flagg. Like, it's one of her own characters that gives a quote.
Right. That's...
And I was like, what an incredible flex for a debut novel to start out by one of your characters that no one knows yet. So that's my first. I can't even get past the first page without having to comment on it.
I feel like I'm going to walk out of this experience when we, like, I haven't read the book before. Yeah. And so when we do that and we do the show, I think I'm probably just going to end up convinced that Fanny Flagg is the most interesting person on earth.
Listen, we can have a whole separate conversation about that. I think it's well.
I'm ready. I'm halfway down that Google hole already. So,
speaking of being halfway done, we kind of half thought through our timing for Moms, Dads, and Grads. Some of it is a Pulitzer's fault, where we would have used that spot next week for Moms, Dads, and Grads. We haven't talked about this, Rebecca, but I think then we're still going to take, we only have a handful. So if you get a recommendation request in now, we'll probably get to it. But at least through next week, we'll take recommendation requests. I'm not sure when we're going to do that show. We're going to miss Mother's Day is what I'm trying to say here. Before that, because Mother's Day, I believe, is a week from Sunday, and you will not have a show to listen to. So you might be dads, grads, and mom later and blame COVID and Amazon's print delivery problems. Get to there. But we're still taking recommendations. I think the recommendation questions we have so far are mostly for me's, which is great. But It's all right.
Yeah, it is all right. Then that I think we can remind people of that too. That if you just need a book request, or like I had an interesting experience. I teach yoga on Monday nights, and I usually ask people, you know, like, does anybody have any requests or anything? And usually, like, one person has something. You know, their hips are sore or whatever. Mm-hmm. And when I got into the Zoom this week, everybody just looked exhausted, and no one had anything. And I was like, do you just need somebody else to be in charge for an hour? And it was sort of universal yeses. And I was like, cool, I got this. But if you just want us to be in charge of your next book selection, we got you.
Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting point because, as you're saying, you know, I think a lot of us are having flagging energy for things we normally do. So is the best way to sort of jumpstart it to try something else, to get outside? You know, is the reason you're in a rut is because that's a normal rut and, you know, you're double rutted? Or is this a good time to try... If you're going to have to make an effort to read something, maybe you might as well use the additional energy to jump out of your normal kinds of reading sorts of situations, which we could talk about there too. Let's see. I think no more sweater listener feedback this week, so I think we're all covered there. Follow up. We talked last week about Publishers Weekly supporting, advocating for, otherwise pumping up this books are essential hashtag, which is all wrapped up in it's sort of an informal lobbying, it seems like, of the powers that be to categorize books as essential so bookstores can open up and not be subject to fines or their penalties. That, you know, a nail salon or something else that's also called non-essential would face. We got into why we thought that was both wrong in a mischaracterization and dangerous and maybe borderline negligent. And this week or whatever week it is, a piece appeared in Publishers Weekly written by two agents, basically saying kind of the same thing that we did, right, Rebecca? Like, what? I don't know what to say. What do you want to say? Did they say anything we didn't say or anything that caught you? We could talk about shouts to PW for publishing this maybe after, which I think
we should do.
What about the story first?
So the agents' names I do want to give them shouts are Eric Hain and Laura Zatz. And they articulated something that I think we both missed, but had been feeling, where the term essential, they highlight, is used to describe workers who perform labor that provides our society with fundamental services. And right now we're talking specifically about healthcare workers and grocery store employees. They say trash collectors, other people who do jobs that keep us safe, clean, and alive. And that it's crucial that essential is a term that's applied to people and the work that they're doing, and that they disagree with applying essential to books, which are a product, with the special and important distinction that this rallying cry of books are essential is happening at the same time that publishing is laying off workers who were already underpaid and overworked. And they say the expression, even coming from an industry periodical, feels almost callous. The product is considered essential, but the people who make it are not. This logic, of course, is older than the pandemic. Quote, a young person's love of books, of working for a meaningful or artistic cause, has long been used as rhetorical leverage to exploit low-level employees. And they go on to say that, you know, if we really want to handle this better as an industry, then relief should be coming from the top down, where the folks highest up with the highest salaries are taking the most pay cuts and trying to keep more of their workers employed by doing that all the way down the chain. I was really glad to see PW mm-hmm. publish this. And I think that words matter. We talk a lot about how words matter, especially right now.
Right.
But the particular way that they unpacked what essential is intended to mean right now, I really appreciated.
Yeah, the argument got a little muddy around cutting top-end salaries at Random House to support indie bookstores. A little unclear mm-hmm. the line they were trying to draw. But I think the top part of the piece, which is, there's a lot of prices paid to call books essential by people that may not be fair to ask them to pay it, to make a more sustainable publishing industry. I mean, who wouldn't want to see that, of course?
Right.
But what does that mean? And how this moment is a learning experience about that? I'm frankly not sure what to say here. I'm not frankly not sure what the way forward here is. I think, you know, we've been talking about multiple, we have a contributor Slack, we have a work Slack, and, you know, a couple other places. We've been talking around some of the same idea. And there's been a little bit of bookshop.org backlash this week, which is maybe mm-hmm. interesting in this context about whether it's saving bookstore, independent bookstores, or supporting them. Is it good that bookshop.org is doing so well? Or should it be the case? Is the sign that they're doing so well really a sign of a gap in the independent bookselling value proposition, fulfillment, online presence sort of thing going on here? And I think one question that anyone involved in the selling of books especially is, this is a good time to reconsider how we do this. Are we doing it in a way that makes sense, that's defensible morally, that's sustainable financially, and resilient economically mm-hmm. to various prices? Because one thing you said is, you know, the bookstores that didn't think online sales or internet presences or online outreach mattered to their bottom line were paying a price they didn't understand for putting all their eggs in getting the foot in the door traffic. And some of that is about diversification of risk. If you don't have, yeah, maybe you give up some in-person sales and people to come in, but then you have people habituated to using your bookstore so you can get 40% of the cover mm-hmm. price of a hardcover, rather than sharing 10% of the price through bookshop.org, which is better than nothing. Like, a lifeboat is better than, you know, treading in the open ocean, but it's not as good as having a more resilient sailboat of your own.
Yeah, when we were discussing that, and it has been really interesting seeing the sort of backlash, criticism of bookshop, you know, the longer that we have this conversation, the more information people have and the more nuanced it gets. And I think that's good for everyone. Mm-hmm. One of our coworkers made the point that, like, well, not all of these bookstores will make it through yep. this and be able to reopen. And I think that that's a really painful price to pay for having made choices about not engaging mm-hmm. your audience. And not all, and I want to be clear, like, I'm aware that not all bookstores that don't survive this will be, will be falling out because they didn't have internet presences. Like, there are a lot of uncontrollable circumstances and awful things that are happening. And there are stores that are struggling right now specifically because they chose not to have sales available on their website, mm-hmm. or they chose not to be on social media because they thought it was beneath them or for the millennials or whatever. And these are all things I've, like, heard directly from people,
yeah.
you know, for reasons that were given for those choices that were made. And so I hope that the stores that do survive this come out of it, you know, determined to build their own connections to their customer bases and to have robust online retail. Like, you know, if we don't have a vaccine soon, we're going to be going back into these shutdowns periodically. Mm-hmm. You want to be able to survive the next one and not have to rely on the 10% you're going to get from Bookshop. I think this is an eye-opening moment in that way. And the stores that are thriving, and there are some stores that are thriving, are only thriving because they paid attention to this before. And they probably weren't doing it because they thought someday they'd have to close their doors for 3 months and only sell on the internet. But they recognize that it's a valuable way to stay in touch with their customers.
Yeah, and it's just a different way. And that kind of diversity of channel has benefits that go beyond sort of a simple arithmetic of we don't like the online or something else. Like, 'cause yeah, I mean, in fairness, you could understand the reasoning, right? If we're competing with online book sales, why buttress the idea of buying books online at all, right? And I think maybe some of the, and maybe that was true at one point, but some of the mistake in the mental model, I think, is saying that all online sales are equivalent to shopping with Big Bad A, and that people who might be your customers can't distinguish between buying books online from your store versus somebody else, which I think we've learned that they can. And Bookshop Rx certainly has shown in this particular moment that people are willing to try, for all intents and purposes, a brand new, no brand name, no sort of loyalty or trust equity solution, just for the pleasure of buying books through a full price, full service, independent bookstore. Like, people are willing to do it.
Yeah, there are a lot of reasons that a customer who likes your store might want to order on the internet instead of coming
in. That's right.
And this is a very dramatic one.
Yeah. And is it so outside the norm that it's unfair to say, I told you so is wrong, but to say, you know, this is something that maybe should shape the future of how all businesses maybe that can diversify out of physical space. I think that's interesting. Not so much different than saying it's not that much different. I can imagine. I wonder if at some point said bookstores would say, we're not going to order books for you. You know, you just buy what's in the store because we want you to come in. We want you to browse or whatever. But like being able to order a book for someone that they pick up in the store, it gives people more ways of buying from you. And it's hard to come up with situations where in a vacuum that strategy is bad. Though on the other hand, should it be different in the book ecosystem where an independent bookstore has to go out of business if it shuts its door for 6 weeks? What insurance in the form of different terms that publishers could offer bookstores? Right. Like, I'm not sure that there's what, if any, lessons are to be learned there. I think it's an interesting question. Like, major publishers can respond to this changing economy. This is a quotation from the piece, to this changing economy in ways that still value their staff by focusing on top-end salary cuts instead of layoffs or furloughs, giving up expensive properties now that we're learning that we can work just fine remotely, and relying less on volatile boom or bust publishing and acquisition strategy, pushing sub rights, treating audio and ebooks as more than just afterthoughts to print, being creative with packaging and pushing existing backlist IP. There are lots of ways to create a steadier industry that doesn't require cutting labor when crisis hits. That's a little tough, but I think it's worth thinking about.
Yeah, I think that they just don't make the line as clear as it could be there, that they're trying to draw the connection of, like, one of the things that we have heard repeatedly is that, like, if publishers gave booksellers better terms and there were better margins on books and better, also better, like, better wholesale discounts and better terms for how returns work and for all of those things, that would create shift in the industry and open up the potential for other kinds of stability, like for bookstores to make enough money to provide insurance for their employees, that kind of thing, or to have a cash reserve for a moment like this. So I think what they're trying to say there is, if publishers didn't have the overhead that they have, they wouldn't have to use the terms and the, like, tighter discounting that they use. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's true. It sounds plausible to me, but I haven't seen all of the spreadsheets. But it certainly makes sense to me that if you're not paying for super fancy offices for all of your employees, because many of them realistically really can telecommute and be just as effective, then you have money freed up. And that money can go somewhere like lightening up the terms or making things more sustainable for indie booksellers, or being part of that, at least. I think that's where they're trying to get. It just doesn't come all the way out.
Yeah, I mean, essentially what they're saying is lower your overhead so that you can keep the same margin and then basically trickle down those savings to increase the margin of bookstores. I mean, it's a nice thought. Does this ever happen this way? Like, are people who work in publishing motivated? And frankly, is it reasonable to ask them to give up salary? I don't know. I'm just not sure. It's like, it's easy to spend other people's money. It's like, oh, you know what's an easy solution to this? You take less and I'll get more. Right? That's an easy solution for everything.
I think it's complicated by the way that publishing talks about independent bookstores.
Yeah.
With so much awe and appreciation, and we love them and we need them, and bookstores are essential, and what would we do without independent bookstores? And like, that's all wonderful, and many, like, I feel that way. I love a bookstore. But when push comes to shove, like, publishers' actions are about protecting the publisher's bottom line, and that's also totally understandable. They are businesses and they have shareholders that they have to report to, and that's how it works. But the discourse in the industry sets up this expectation, I think, that, well, if publishers really do value their relationship with indie bookstores, if they really do rely on events held in bookstores and these booksellers' ties to their local communities and their ability to, like, take a book and hand sell it into becoming a bestseller, if these things are really valuable, then put your money where your mouth is and do something to help us. And the gross unspoken thing there is maybe publishing doesn't value independent bookstores as much as they would like independent bookstores to think.
I think that's fair, and it reminds me of when I talked to Guy Gonzalez about the Panorama Project, and it's like they're trying to understand the value, in a capital V, you know, gross capitalist value of library services to publishing's bottom line. Because if it's more than they think it is, then they're undercapitalizing on an opportunity. And if it's less than they understand it to be, then they're protecting library revenue streams at the cost of something else. So it's really, are you doing what you think is the right thing, and is it the right thing at the same time? Is it the case that publishing should, from its own survival point of view, subsidize is the wrong term, alter the terms of the agreement writ large that they have with booksellers for their own bottom line, or should they do it out of vocational awe for indie books, you know, to use the same kind of idea? The very same, I mean, it's possible that's coming from the same, the getting to two different conclusions from the same directions. Our books are essential, hashtag, here's a picture of me reading my awesome book, we all love bookstores. Is that coming from the same place to say that publishing should move out of its offices and cut salaries to support independent bookstores? The implicit argument there is, they're dumb if they don't, or is it they're bad people if they don't, right? Those are two different questions, actually. Are they dumb business people if they don't, or are they sort of evil people somehow if they don't? And I think that evaluation is conflated a lot of times. I think publishing knows what it's doing. I think one thing I've learned doing this job is that more people do know what they're doing more than you think, and everybody has their reasons. Everybody has their reasons for doing the thing they're doing. They're not sitting around like on a pile of good ideas that should be implemented with their thumb up their butt. Like, they have reasons they're not doing stuff. No, I mean, I'm serious, Rebecca. Like, it's so easy to say, well, those people should be doing something else when it doesn't affect me in any way, right? Well, frankly, it does affect a lot of these people. What motivation does an executive at Insert Publishing House here to cut their salary by $50,000 to trickle down for $50 a piece for 1,000 bookstores? Like, it's so hard to make that argument in a way that makes sense to anybody. So I don't know. I think, you know, one of the things that we're seeing here is any kind of event like this exposes tensions within any situation, whether it's your family situation, educational system, economic system. But I think it is bringing to bear in the space of a couple sentences in the space of a couple paragraph breaks, moving from protect workers to publishers to cut their salaries. A fascinating jump about how we understand where the value is and where someone can, quote unquote, sacrifice for somebody else.
Yeah. And I've been seeing a lot of analogous discussions about the restaurant industry.
Yeah.
And probably other industries, but books and restaurants right. are the ones that I'm paying attention to. I'd actually be really interested in it if listeners are seeing these in other places, restaurants though being so widely closed right now, that you're seeing people talk about what should be different when we come mm-hmm. back. And in the immediate, it's stuff like better protection, both, you know, physically for workers and also economically. But looking at like what's actually sustainable for restaurants, how many restaurants does a city need to support? Like Amanda and I were talking about how in Richmond, I think there was a report last week that like 9 of the bajillion restaurants here that are closed for the pandemic have already announced that they will not be reopening. They're closing permanently. And I was telling her, like, 9 actually seems really low to me. Like, yeah. we're in a city with a huge number of restaurants. It's kind of astonishing that we were supporting as many restaurants as we were before. And I think this does, as you were saying, expose a lot of tensions or expose a lot of businesses that were like just sort of barely making mm-hmm. it. And what is sustainable for the community to continue supporting is very likely going to look different after this, and how that shakes out is going to be interesting and painful. And I think it will be different. But for like worker protections with income, I was seeing for the restaurant industry, a lot of suggestions that the industry should move away from the tip-based yeah. pay model. And so that workers will get, so servers especially will get like a baseline pay that's, you know, much higher, that allows them to access health insurance and better unemployment benefits and all kinds of things that would be unlocked that are better for them. But the model where they rely on tips benefits the businesses. Mm-hmm. So how do you shake that out if you're a business owner?
Yeah. Anyway, I mean, and shouts to Publishers Weekly for publishing. It's not easy to publish something that mm-hmm. calls you out and says you're not only wrong, but being dangerous. So that's a good job on their part. Interesting piece to look at. Eric Kane and Laura Zatz. Good job from you guys, too. Mm-hmm. We'd spent a little more time on that than we thought. We had some juice there, but let's do another sponsor and do some other stuff.
Today's episode is brought to you by Song of the Silk's Realms by Judy I. Lin. Xu Wei is a talented young musician who was orphaned at a young age. Her sole family is a kindly uncle, but then her uncle is killed, and she is, of course, devastated. With no family and no patron, Xu Wei is facing the possibility of a lifetime of servitude playing the qin. Then one night, she is unexpectedly called to perform for the enigmatic Duke Meng. He surprises Xu Wei further with an irresistible offer. Serve as a musician in residence at his manor for 1 year, and he'll set her free of her indenture. But the Duke's motives become increasingly more sus when he and Xu Wei barely survive an attack by a nightmarish monster. It's like, what? What's going on here? So this book is a sweeping epic romantasy that follows a talented young musician who is swept away to the celestial realm by an enigmatic young duke. And who doesn't want to be swept away to the celestial realm by an enigmatic young duke? She's living all our dreams, honestly. Make sure to check out the new book. And thanks again to Song of the Six Realms by Judy I. Lin for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Penguin Team. In a world where the children of the gods inherit their powers, a descendant of the Greek Fates must solve a series of impossible murders to save her sisters, her soulmate, and her city. Descendants of the Fates are always born in threes. There's one to weave, one to draw, and one to cut the threads that connect people to the things they love and to life itself. And the Aura sisters are no exception. There is Io, the youngest, who uses her Fate-born abilities as a private investigator, but her latest job leads her to a horrific discovery. Somebody is abducting women and setting the results resulting wraiths loose in the city to kill. Now, the second book in the series, Hearts That Cut, will be on sale June 18th, 2024. This is a must read for all Greek mythology and fantasy fans. This is dripping with atmosphere, edged with danger. Threads That Bind weaves together a gorgeous dark tapestry of mystery, faded romance, and modern myth. You won't be able to put this one down, and that comes from Alexandra Bracken, New York Times bestselling author of Lore. So make sure to pick up Threads That Bind by Kitsa Hatsopoulou, and thanks again to Penguin Teen for sponsoring this episode.
All right. Literacy as a constitutional right is not, again, I'm not deep in the weeds of literacy and teaching of writing and composition in early childhood literacy is its own field, right? It's its own, you know, genre of education that exists alongside and in support of, and has its own field of theory too. But this ruling, the U.S. Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals held this week that access to a basic minimum education that can plausibly impart literacy is a fundamental constitutionally projected right. This came out of a claim that the state of Michigan failed to provide a suitable education to a plaintiff group of Detroit public school students after invoking the state's emergency management powers to take over control of the schools. At the trial, plaintiffs argued that they were forced to sit in classrooms that were functionally incapable of delivering access to literacy, marked by unqualified instructors and a dearth of textbooks and other school supplies. The result, a number of students with zero or near zero proficiency levels on state-administered exams. An interesting idea with fascinating ramifications that I think is in part about funding levels, I would think, at some point. Like, where the rubber would meet the road on this is if the city of Detroit is found to be negligent, then that suggests that the state and city have a fiduciary responsibility to support and tax appropriately to support this kind of education. I have never seen a case like this. I looked around. I couldn't see kind of a where in the Constitution, like what were they pointing to that says this is a protected right? But I'd be fascinated to see. And I wondered if we had some legal mavens out there that could comment on us. What did you take from this? Did you see where they were pointing to, like, where in the Constitution are they gleaning or inferring this right?
No, but I also didn't go as far down this rabbit hole as I would have liked to. Right at the top of this piece, I think, is an important core of it, that the court holds that basic literacy is implicit in the concept of ordered liberty because it's central to the basic exercise of other fundamental rights, including political participation. So, like, from that, I took, like, my inference there is, like, that we all have the right to vote, to exercise and participate in these fundamental rights, exercising, you know, the concept of ordered liberty. But in order to do that, we have to be able to understand what it is that we're voting on, and understand how we want to participate politically. And literacy is the core of that. I think this is, it's really interesting. I don't think I know enough about it to say much more. Beyond that, this feels like a powerful idea to me in a political moment like the one we've been living in for the last 4 years, where analysis of information and the ability to take in information and be literate about access to information first, like the ability to read the information that is available to you and then to understand and parse it, is certainly important for exercising your political rights, and feels very important in a time when there's a lot of misinformation and intentionally bad information being disseminated. I don't think the timing is intentional there. Like, this happened in the state of Michigan in, like, previous to 2016, and the court case happened in 2016, and this has been going through appeals. But I feel like a stirring in my soul in a nice way about this concept that literacy is crucial for all of us to have if we are all to exercise fundamental rights, including being part of the political process.
Yeah, I did just a little Googling of, because this has to be a relatively new idea that, you know, to be able to read is not, I mean, we've seen ways in which historically literacy tests have been used to keep people from the polls, right? Especially black people in the South. Because, like, basically using the same argument, well, if you can't read, then you can't vote. Well, this is sort of the other way around. The duty is not on the individual to be able to read. The duty is on the state, essentially, to be able to read. Any guess what the literacy rate in the U.S. in 1870 was? Just to pick a random number that I have.
In 1870.
Yeah, what percent of the entire adult population was illiterate? It's both high and low.
Illiterate or literate? Okay, I'm going to guess.
Illiterate. What percent is illiterate?
illiterate in 1870. Yeah.
This is unfair.
Illiterate, 65%. That feels low.
Only 20%. Only 20%.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. Today in the U.S., it's 1%.
Okay.
But 80%.
I got to brush up on history,
it's unfair.
Man.
That was, it's unfair. It's unfair.
That feels like a miss by an embarrassing proportion.
No, I would have missed equally. I was like, well, no one could read in 1870. But 80% of the black population was illiterate for, I think, reasons that are distressing and historically obvious. Mm-hmm. 1870, yeah. Coming out of the Civil War. By 1900, we moved to 44% of black people were illiterate. So in 30 years, cutting in half, that restoration was a wild time. But, you know, the idea here that the state has fallen down in its responsibility to provide the service for which it's intended, mm-hmm. right? I mean, I guess in some ways it makes a plain text sense of, like, if your school isn't doing the things schools are for, you're negligent. That makes sense.
Yeah, and the thing that your taxpayers are paying for, right, you know? Like, I'm paying taxes that go to schools, and I don't have kids because, like, first of all, I don't have a choice, right, because that's how taxes work. But I believe in it, mm-hmm. because I want to live in a society with an educated populace that can make good choices.
That's one that, you know, it's not really in the realm of our influence, but seems like a big enough story that it was worth commenting on for those of you who are, I know so many of you out there care, as we do, about, you know, how public policy and reading and books get, you know, enmeshed in a lot of ways. Speaking of, did we cover this story on the show last week? I feel like maybe.
I don't think we did.
Yeah, we must have dropped it off at the end, but a school board in Alaska pulled classics, including The Great Gatsby, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, and others from the school curriculum. What would you even call the reasons? I mean, besides dumb.
It's a real grab bag. Yeah. So the Matanuska Susitna Borough School Board, it's in Palmer, Alaska. They oversee 46 schools. Mm-hmm. So that's meaningful, too. This is not like one school that we're seeing a challenge in. They removed 5 books. It's Gatsby, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, Catch 22, Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man, and The Things They Carried by Tim O'Brien. And the reasons include, like, for I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, sexually explicit material, such as the sexual abuse the author suffered as a child. And, like, equating a depiction of sexual abuse with being sexually explicit is problematic on a thousand levels. They also say that there's anti-white messaging in I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. Fitzgerald's Gatsby was pulled for language and sexual references. Invisible Man was marked for containing language, rape, and incest. Catch 22 was included for violence, a handful of racial slurs, and the fact that the characters speak with military men misogyny and racist attitudes of the time. Mm. So, like, in this grab bag, we have that I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings is not okay because it supposedly has anti-white messaging, and Catch 22 isn't okay because it contains, like, 1940s era racism. Mm. It just feels like a bunch of people got uncomfortable about a bunch of things and took a moment to try to remove these books, or who they did vote successfully to remove the books. This was also done on a digital conference, because everything is digital during the coronavirus pandemic. And folks certainly felt, and one person says in this piece, that they thought the board had tried to slip it under the radar. The best part of this, though, is that the citizens of Alaska in this school board have rallied around to oppose this decision, and formed a group of parents and a group of, I'm not sure it's all parents, just a group of citizens that are basically bribing / rewarding students. They'll pay you $100 if you read all 5 of these books that were just removed from your school.
Yeah, it's one of the more, I don't even know how to say it. I guess it feels obtuse about literature in a way that we don't see when we talk about these kinds of stories that often. It's not that there are some, like, anything difficult is subject to anything.
Mm-hmm.
everything difficult is subject to inspection. It doesn't seem to have a neat left-right sort of alliance as sometimes we see it. Well, let's be honest, it's mostly from the right, mostly, almost exclusively from the right. So it's interesting to see, and also, like, this list is probably, if you're making a list of the 50 contenders for the great American novel, I know why the Cage we're seeing is sort of part memoir, part fiction. Let's throw it on there because there are rules, get your own podcast. There are five of the 50 that would be, if you left them off, you'd be like, what are you doing? Like, what why are we even having this conversation if you're going to leave them off?
Right. And then, like, I don't know what was on the list or what has remained on the reading list, but yes, it's notable that, you know, a lot of the books that we do see commonly challenged, or the classics that are commonly challenged, aren't on here. Like, there's no Huck Finn, which has a lot of the N-word. Yeah. There's no To Kill a Mockingbird, which also has very problematic depictions of race. Like, their reasoning is unclear, except for, like, at the very bottom of this piece in The Guardian, they quote Jeff Taylor, who's one of the board members. He voted in favor of the removal. He also admitted to only having read The Great Gatsby out of those five books. He said that he voted in favor of the removal because he, quote, wants to give parents more freedom, control, and involvement in determining what their children read. I have no doubt that these books will be read more in the near future than they have been in the recent past. There are even rewards being offered for those who read them. I applaud those who choose to read these books on their own accord. I applaud parents and caregivers who are involved in their students' education, blah, blah, blah. If these are books that interest you, by all means, check them out. That's the beauty of freedom. But it's this weird, like, almost libertarian thing of, like, everyone should just decide what they read and everyone should decide what their children get to read. And if that's true, then why bother having school reading lists at all? Like, why are they not abolishing the concept of school reading lists if the idea here is to give parents more freedom instead of just taking off these five? Also, it fundamentally misunderstands, like, why we have educators, but that's
a whole other situation. And it really invites the question of, if you're going to ban these kinds of books with such a sort of carpet bombing objection to discomfort of any kind, you know, if it's this kind of racial talk, or if it's offensive, or there's violence, or there's sex, or there's other kinds of things, what are we doing here? Why are we even having high school literature courses? They don't, right. I think this is one of those situations, they fundamentally don't want to engage with the kinds of ideas that these books bring up, right? And so one way around that is to say, well, this isn't, I mean, it's, we also don't see high school list challenged anymore, like, very rarely, right, Rebecca?
Yeah,
like,
it's true.
Very rarely, we're actually talking about a high school reading list. It feels like that's ground that's largely been covered and non-contested at this point. And maybe these people also don't understand how the internet works around stories like this more. Like, I don't know where the Manuska Sestina Borough School District in Alaska is. I'm guessing that they were surprised to see it in the New York Times, which I did see a story about the New York Times this morning.
Yeah.
Which is great.
I had a friend.
Which is great.
Yeah, this was one of those things that bubbled up, like, outside the bookish world, where when I woke up, I think on Tuesday morning this week, I had a text from a friend who gets up way earlier than I do that was a link to this story from Apple News. And she was like, can you believe this business? And I was first like, oh, friend, this happens all the time.
Right.
But she owns a yoga studio. So, like, she only knows of the book ban attempts that make their way up to something like Apple News. And that's always how I have a sense of, like, oh, this one really was a big deal, that it made its way out there. Like, yeah, this is real. This happens. People are still doing this and they're doing it all the time. And this is, I think, one of the more confusing ones because it isn't clear what value it's trying to protect other than, as you were saying, not having to engage with anything difficult or troubling under the guise of, like, let parents decide it all. But, like, if you want to decide everything your kid reads, I invite you to homeschool them.
Yeah, and I don't even know, like, where would you go? Like, where would you go for high, like, what? I can't pick Shakespeare. There's sex, there's violence, people die. Okay, you don't understand the insults and expletives. That's, you know, doesn't mean they're not there. Like you said, Huck Finn, I'm not going there. I'm not going to Poe. I'm not going to Melville. I'm not going to Faulkner. I'm not going to, I don't know, Charles Dickens. I'm not going to Dostoevsky. I'm not going to Tolstoy. Mm-mm. I'm not going to Turgenev. I mean, where are you going? Where are you going? It's so wild. Like, I mean, it's like almost like the Mitch McConnell thing of starving the beast, right? Like, don't fund the things. You know they're going to fail, don't fund them and let them fail, and then it means we don't need the thing. I'm sorry, I'm getting political right here for a second. Like, oh, look at that thing that's failing that we didn't give any money to. Boy, looks like that thing doesn't work. It's like, okay, you don't want people to have you're not comfortable with people engaging with anything interesting or difficult or meaningful or complicated. And, you know, the reason it breaks out, I think, is both useful and a little troubling, is that if this list included George by Alex Gino or I Am Jazz by Jazz Jennings, we would be talking about it, but it doesn't make the New York Times. It makes it because it's The Great Gatsby, right, Rebecca? Like, I think that's the other piece of this we need to say out loud. Like, even yes, if this is I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, Invisible Man and Catch 22, it's not making the list. It's because of the Great Gatsby. It's because white people read this stuff and they care about it.
Yes. Yeah. And that's exactly it. And that, like, it may very well be time to revisit what we consider canonical and what gets taught in English classes. And we've talked about, like, take To Kill a Mockingbird off your syllabus. Yeah. There are other ways to talk about the history of racism in this country. And that's fine. But this is also not an investigation of the canon.
No.
This is also, I think, just also a fundamental misunderstanding of the purpose of books, period.
That's right. Or why people who care about literature care about literature. I think writ large is this kind of thing. So now I'm all head up about that.
I know, not to mention that, like, Invisible Man is your favorite.
It's not
novel.
Cool. And we both love the things they carry. And, like, I stand for all these books, actually.
Catch 22 is one of my longstanding favorites. Maya Angelou is just untouchable. You have The Great Gatsby. There's so much to talk about and learn there. Yeah. And we both do deeply stand for the things they carry. Like, I feel very personally victimized by the school board of Alaska.
Yeah, I was trying to think, like, if you were trying to get the reaction you got from this, would you pick? Yeah, I don't think you could pick a more provocative. Maybe To Kill a Mockingbird, you could swipe out the things they carried. A lot of people don't know the things they carried.
Yeah, if you put on, like, To Kill a Mockingbird and...
I'm trying to think of what else you... I mean, Huck Finn's been around the block so many times, I don't think you get anything there. Maybe Shakespeare. Maybe you put on Hamlet. Like, well,
Romeo
and
Juliet.
Pride and Prejudice. Yeah. Right, something like that.
Oh, man, I would love to see a story about a school board trying to ban Jane Austen.
Yeah. I mean, I guess Pride and Prejudice doesn't have anything.
It's safe.
Except for all the, you know, structural misogyny. That's actually somehow even differently terrifying, but that's a different situation that's beyond the scope of this. Anyway, let's end with good news and a couple of different.
Today's episode is brought to you by Bloom Books. Charming, easygoing, and rich, Xavier Castillo has the world at his fingertips. He also has no interest in taking over his family's empire, but that hasn't stopped women from throwing themselves at him. Unless, of course, the woman in question is his publicist. The cool, the intelligent, the ambitious Sloane Kensington, who is a high-powered publicist who's used to dealing with difficult clients, but none infuriate or tempt her more than a certain billionaire heir with his stupid dimples and laid-back attitude. She may be forced to work with him, but she'll never fall for him because he's a client and that's all he'll ever be. Right? Right, girl. Like, we all know. So, just in case you didn't know, author Anna Wong is the best-selling author and book talk viral author of the Twisted Love series, the King of Sin series. Miss Wong got it going on, okay? Make sure to check out King of Sloth by Anna Wong. And thanks again to Bloom Books for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Sourcebooks Landmark. So King Solomon says something very interesting to his son before he dies, and that is, quote, "Don't let the white man take the house," end quote. These, as I just mentioned, are King Solomon's last words to his son as he dies. Now, all four Solomon siblings must return to North Carolina to save the kingdom, their ancestral home, and 200 acres of land from a development company. Told in Alternating Viewpoints, Long After We Are Gone by Tara Shelton Harris, is a searing portrait of the power of family and letting go of things that no longer serve you, exploring the burden of familial expectations, the detriment of miscommunication, and the lessons and legacies we pass on to our children. It's an explosive and emotional story of four siblings, each fighting their own personal battle, because who isn't, who return home in the wake of their father's death. Make sure to check out Long After We Are Gone by Tara Shelton Harris. And thanks again to Sourcebooks Landmark for sponsoring this episode.
France. This is one of the things I'm surprised I haven't seen something like this before. Maybe it's out there, but again, the book itself is so out of scale and exemplary that it's hard to use it as evidence of anything. But Becoming by Michelle Obama is going to be a documentary on Netflix, presumably out, I think, does it say here, out of the Obama's, you know, production deal? They have their own Higher Ground. I can't remember what it is. Yeah, it is here. So they have a production company. They have the book. They have the deal. So they have all the pieces. And let's be honest, the best-selling nonfiction book of all time, I think, is what we're talking about, at least in year sales. It's going to be a documentary. Seems like a natural and maybe a duh kind of a moment for very... good, very, very, very popular memoirs where the people are still alive and you could do the thing in the room. I don't know.
And it's a documentary made basically of while she was on book tour for Becoming. So I'm kind of fascinated that we didn't get this story until April 27th about the documentary dropping on
Who
May
are all those
6th?
Guys with cameras all over the place?
Right. Yeah. It makes so much sense. She went on a huge tour and the book was just a huge sensation. It has to be fascinating to, you know, be behind the scenes with her on a tour like that, talking about her life, transitioning out of being the first lady and into this version of private citizen and author and just icon. I'm ready to watch this. I think it's going to be really interesting. Amanda and Jen and I went to see her speak on tour in DC and Barack showed up. And my first thought was like, oh, maybe some of it was filmed there, you know, but like there are thousands of people who went to see her on these tours and are going to watch this and many, many more who want to be part of that. I think it's super smart. Now I've been trying to think about like who else with a big memoir and a big book tour.
Well, I mean,
there have
if
been
you
a
have
documentary
a
bit,
you don't always know at the time who has a big book. You need the celebrity for the thing to have a book tour where you film it on site, right? I was thinking like so often we see like a memoir like this get turned into a you know sort of a regular movie that has a star playing the thing, but I think a documentary is so smart because if people care about the book, they want to see the actual person. Also, the budgets are much lower for documentaries. It's much cheaper to make a documentary. Yeah, like, if you made Educated with Tara Westover a documentary of it, like...
That was about to be my example.
Oh, I could feel it, so I had to jump on it. I had to get on it before you could say it, because that's my idea. I get credit, Internet.
We've never thought the same thing at the same time before. Yeah, yeah. I think Educated is a perfect example there. These big memoirs for people, as you were saying, are invested in the author and that person and their story and their life. And like what happened with Tara Westover and the way that book blew up was really incredible. Like I would like a similar one about Megan Phelps Roper, whose book about leaving Westboro Baptist Church, like it didn't blow up in the way that Educated did, but her life in the wake of writing that book and then like really telling her story publicly has been very interesting. I don't know. I went to see Hillary Clinton on the tour for What Happened, and I probably would have cried for all 3 hours of the documentary, but I would watch a documentary about that process for sure. I would like to see more of this.
Yeah. I mean, you think of something like, and again, she's top of mind because I don't know if you know this. Do you know Helen McDonald has a new book coming out in August? Did I tell you this?
I am aware of this,
we talked about it on the
show?
Did we talk about it on the Deal show?
I think we did. I don't know if it was Helen McDonald or I don't know if it was the Deal show or if it was just like private Muppet Arming.
Yeah, I can't remember.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's a spoiler for a future Deal show. But like H is for Hawk, right? Sold very well. Yeah. Literary, perfect for a bespoke kind of streaming service. You don't need to open in a bunch of movie theaters. You just need... You know, 100,000 jerks like me to watch it and keep my Netflix subscription, and it doesn't cost as much to do. I think I hadn't really thought about the memoir as a documentary, kind of a I don't even know, but like a venue to build off of a book's success without becoming now it's starring Jessica Chastain as Tara Westover. Like Hillbilly Elegy, which is being turned into a movie by, you know, a regular movie coming on Netflix by Ron Howard. starring, I don't know who it's starring. I have no idea. Maybe it's Jessica Chastain, for all I know. Maybe that's what I remember. But like, that movie is a documentary, to me, is like 10,000 times more interesting than the
right,
the,
or like my most recent memoir example, because I just finally got around to reading it after you recommended it to me years ago, is Barbarian Days by William Finnegan. Like a documentary interviewing him and a bunch of those other people.
Surf
that, like,
footage.
Yeah, fantastic. Surfers in the 60s and 70s before surf culture took over and like created destinations. I'm 100% here for that.
Yeah, anyway, so I'm excited to see this. I haven't yet gotten to Becoming. It's one of those, I'm going to get to that eventually, and then it, you know how it falls into that valley of you didn't get to it, but there's also not a reason to pick it up now. But I am very interested to see how this pans out.
I'll have to say, like, I thought she was Michelle was like a little more controlled on the page in Becoming than I was hoping she would be. Like, there was more openness and personality and, like, you know, real stories from their life. And I totally understand why she would want to be like more controlled or hold more things back. But I love watching her when she is just open. and I'm hoping that this, like, you know, behind the scenes stuff, certainly she's aware that there's a camera there.
Yeah.
But it's a different situation from like sitting on stage answering a planned question that you know is going to be like filmed and tweeted and Instagrammed and all that stuff.
Yeah. Do you get a little, like, you know, walking from the stage to the bus or the green room, do you get a little loosening of the shoulders? And I guess loosening of the lips, along with it, you want to hear some of that spontaneousness. Mm-hmm. Last one, it's not really a story that we have much comment, but kind of just an announcement of people that might be eligible or be interested in. We Need Diverse Books is launching an emergency fund for diverse creatives and children's publishing. Emergency grants of $500 each to diverse writers, illustrators, and publishing professionals affected by the pandemic. There's submission guidelines. Put a link in the show notes there. You can also make a donation if you'd like to support this fund in any way. You know, this is a good time to think about where you're going to give and what you want to support in these times. Mm-hmm. A little goes a long way. So that's diversebooks.org. And listening, I know, can be hard to come back and look at the show notes. You can find it there. But as always, you can find links to this story and all of the stuff we talked about at bookriot.com. Listen, you can navigate there to the Book Riot podcast. Get us your recommendation requests. They can be for you or not. They can be for anyone. You know, whatever you're interested in reading more about. You know, we got a request this week for an episode of doing our favorite books episode.
Oh.
Which is a little too much tire for me to try to ride at some point. But we might try as we get into summertime. Maybe we'll do more themed. People really like the Traveling Without Moving episode that we did that was themed.
Yeah, that was fun.
I don't think a general best books will get us anywhere, but maybe we'll try.
But
we could slice it up. We can slice up a pig.
I think we could drill down into like more specific sections of our favorites, but we have enough sort of like topical overlap to be able to do that. Yeah, for sure.
Pulitzer
Company. And at some point this summer, Jeff, we have to figure out what we're going to do with Marilyn Robinson.
You know, I'm holding that in abeyance. I have a couple things I'm holding in abeyance. We need to get to a summer preview. Some of it is we're waiting for the summer pub dates to settle down.
Right, right.
We have a summer preview we need to do. We have half-baked ideas we need to do. We're going to both contribute some half-baked ideas. I also think, based on a conversation you and I had yesterday, what we're into during our quarantines. It's kind of a non-book episode because we spent a long time talking about, let's not spoil it, about something we're both into right now. Both of our households are into right now.
Sort of a mid-year version of the best of the rest of the holidays.
But these are unusual times, so maybe we'll jump in there. So we got stuff coming up, but you'll next hear from us now if you're listening to this early in May for the Pulitzers. I guess it feels like 5,000 years ago, 2019, in the books that came out in 2019.
Yeah.
So Trust Exercise won the National Book Award. Sometimes that means you're the favorite. I think that was kind of went over. It didn't go over like a lead balloon. I'm not sure the legs on that book have been great after the National Book Award. I don't know. There's too much stock to put in it, I would say my favorite going in to the National Book Awards was Nickel Boys. I still think maybe that's where I put my most money, but because of the December 31st, Such a Fun Age, Kylie Reid, I've got a little bit of a dark horse, you know, a side bet at the track. on such a fun age. Does anything else come to mind for the fiction category as a favorite or something you'd like to, you think deserving that you'd pull for?
I think On Earth We're Briefly Gorgeous has a shot there.
Right. I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right about that. I wish I would have thought of that. So that's a good pick too.
You know, you thought of Educated first.
Well, by maybe a half a second. And I was just because I was talking. I don't know. Like, it's hard to know. We're always so wrong about this with Pulitzers.
And I feel like I'm wronger about the Pulitzer than anything else because there's no short list to go from. And there's no long list. There's no narrowing at all. So it's just like, imagine all the books that came out last year and pick three.
Yeah, good luck. Good luck. So it'll be exciting to talk about books we haven't read. No, maybe we'll have read. I mean, we've read these books, so if it's one of those, that,
Who knows?
We're talking about. So read and watch your Fried Green Tomatoes. We're into that. The book is longer than I thought. Did you catch that? Mm. Seems a little bit longer. I'm sure it'll go quick.
Oh, yeah. Anyway. Maybe it's just your mass market paperback looking.
Oh, you know what?
Squatty.
I haven't picked up a mass market paperback in a while. And I forget the chunks are quality.
The trade paperback that I'm holding. Actually, I mean, it's 420 pages. That's
seems
a little long.
Seems long.
Yeah, 385 before the recipes start, it seems like.
Yeah,
that's all right. On the long side, but also the font is enormous in mine.
I can't shut up about it. So this is we'll get out on this because I had the thoughts about thinking about, we talked about when we were doing the nominations for it, that it felt ahead of its time. And it got me wondering about the invention of the category of women's fiction. Do we know, like, what? I don't feel like that was a thing in the 60s, 70s, and 80s necessarily. But I think there might be a reasonable case that if it's not the first, if it's not the Archaeopteryx of the birds that became women's fiction, that it feels like Fried Green Tomatoes of the Whistle Stop Cafe could be a harbinger. And then when women's fiction as an idea and as a category really picked up, I'd love to know the history of that idea. And maybe I'm wildly wrong, but my sense is that this is like a proto version of what we would now call women's fiction, but I don't think it would have been called that when this came out. Do you have a sense of it, Rebecca?
Ooh, I don't.
Yeah. Maybe I'll do some homework in anticipation of the show. But that was one observation I had going in. It's like, oh, I think we'd call this women's fiction now, but I don't think we would have called it that then, or it was called that then.
Yeah, it's interesting. My copy has a blurb on the back from Harper Lee.
I have that in my notes, an unbelievable blurb.
And quotes from reviews in the New York Times, the LA Times, the Washington Post, and the Houston Chronicle. Mm-hmm. And a seal on the spine for the Random House Readers Circle, which is like a traditionally book club marketed thing towards women readers. But getting reviews in the New York Times, the LA Times, and the Washington Post is not something that typically happens to the stuff that we, like, you know, sort of have ghettoized traditionally as women's fiction, or in however long that tradition has existed. Maybe it does feel like you don't get to the Divine Secrets of the Yaya Sisterhood without passing through the Whistle Stop Cafe. Mm-hmm.
and I should say, I don't use that term derogatory. I use it in the term that in the way that it's sort of used as a category, right? You know, in my worldview, the discussion about the condescension towards women fiction is sort of the Franz and Jennifer Weiner thing from 5-6 years ago when we first started doing this, and I know that it was before that as well, but like, I bet I can find an academic study about
somebody's got a thesis about
this. Because like Pride and Prejudice, right? But we didn't call it, it wasn't a commercial category in the way we think of it now, like but anyway, putting into that kind of modern literary context, because it does feel like a vestige of an older time of literary publishing and reading, but also has a modern sensibility. So I think it's going to be interesting to look in that through that lens. Okay. So after really winding down, I spun back up. So we're going to try to wind
it
back
happens.
Down. Rebecca, we'll talk to you later.
Have a good one.